just one other question, though, about magic and myth, because what it brings up for me is the very first time I ever met you when I came over to your house one evening and you explained the pre-trans fallacy to me.
Right.
And this was very mind-blowing, mind-expanding. I thought a lot of how confused, actually, I was between things that were pre-rational, what you're calling now magic and mythic, and post-rational, trans-rational.
Right.
And so my question, I guess, is when you look at this from the outside, let's say you have someone doing a divination. How do you know if this divination is happening at this magic, mythic level where the person's believing that the coins they're throwing, or this is some great guru who's using divination to help them make important decisions in a trans-rational way?
We're going to talk about astrology, too, aren't we?
We are, Ken. We're gonna, all the metaphysical topics will come your way.
Well, we'll sort of talk about it in general terms. We'll talk about the pre-trans fallacy, sort of what it does and what it doesn't do. Not everything falls into the pre-trans fallacy, but a lot of stuff does. And so you sort of start and look at the things that can more easily be explained by it. And then you get to these very difficult things, which we already sort of mentioned when we're talking about the difference between magic and actual psychic capacities, or mythic thoughts versus real high archetypes or higher spiritual images and so on. Now, those right there are an example of a pre and trans occasions. So the idea, I generally came about this because I probably for about 10 years in my 20s when I was first writing and first started studying this, there was a certain sort of epidemic confusion going on. And it really just eventually drove me nuts because I was sort of trying to make sense out of this and put together some of these coherent maps. And these things were always sort of gumming up the works. And the first one that I tended to notice was this pre-trans fallacy. Because what tends to happen is we come in, we meaning us of the modern era, and we're kind of rational, we're at this general wave 5, level 5, rational orientation. We don't live in a magic society, we're a mythic society. And so, but sooner or later, we realize that there are things higher, deeper, wider. There's transrational, spiritual, transpersonal levels, waves, states, experiences, and so on. We didn't talk about the others, but you can see a sort of general notion about what pluralistic, integral, and transpersonal are. These are higher modes of being, awareness, consciousness, love, bliss, and so on. So people tend to make a very sort of quick kind of classification. And it's rational is bad, anything non-rational is good. So egoic is bad, anything non-egoic is good. Personal is bad, anything non-personal is good. Verbal is bad, anything non-verbal is good. And so pretty logic is really bad, anything non-logical is good. It's all sort of summarized in rational and non-rational. And then from there, it's sort of, then you start talking about cartographies like Apollonian, Dionysian, and there's just sort of these two-tiered sort of classifications, where Apollonian is bad, Dionysian is wild and free and creative and so on. The more I looked at that, the more it became obvious that that really was a bit of a problem. It wasn't that neat and it wasn't that simple. In particular, if you look at developmental sequences, there are stages leading up to rational, and we can call them pre-rational, and then there are the stages higher than rational. Then they're post-rational or trans-rational and so on. And because pre-rational and trans-rational are both non-rational in their own way, they start to look very similar, sort of at first glance. So all of a sudden you're treating pre-rational states and trans-rational states as if they're kind of the same. And then you develop, so then you have rational and non-rational. And that was a really just a catastrophe, as far as I could tell, because one of two things happen if you confuse pre and trans. You can take Freud and Jung as sort of classic examples of two guys that committed this in sort of opposite directions. Freud took every trans-rational, genuinely mystical, transpersonal, spiritual state he saw and reduced it to pre-rational, infantile state. So for Freud, any of these sort of wonderfully high mystical experiences were nothing but infantile, oceanic feelings, regression to the womb, that kind of thing. And even in some very famous letters with Rilke and several mystics, Freud would say, well, gee, that's very beautiful, but it's the future of an illusion. It's childish. It's nonsense. Jung, Carl Jung, on the other hand, tended to go in the other direction and take a lot of pre-rational images and elevate them to some sort of trans-rational spiritual glory. Some of them are, many of them aren't. And you have to be a little bit more careful in your distinctions about that. So what I started to do is really kind of try to tease apart things that were pre-rational. In that case, it would mean archaic, magic, are mythic, and then those that could be post-rational, trans-rational, post-formal, transformal, transverbal, translinguistic, however you want to kind of word those. And a lot of the higher levels of all of the developmental lines we talked about are post-rational. And even modern developmental psychologists talk about post-formal stages of development. And we find that in cognition, we find it in affects, we find it in interpersonal relations, and so on. So again, not everything goes to the developmental level, so you can't pigeonhole everything in terms of a pre-trans fallacy. But many, many, many of the confusions that are out there come from one of those two errors. Either people, the standard rationalist materialist, taking all of these trans, rational, transpersonal states and reducing them to infantile pablum. And then on the other hand, a little bit too enthusiastic taking of infantile and pre-rational states as if those were somehow evidence of a great liberated non-dual consciousness, which almost certainly, almost never the case.
So to reiterate
my
question.
So how do you do divination?
How do you?
We'll find out if it actually works or not.
Is that the way? My question is how do you distinguish between the person who's functioning in a pre-rational versus
right.
a trans-rational way
right.
when it comes to something like divination, tarot cards, anything like
exactly.
that?
Exactly. Well, here, Roger Walsh has done a lot of work on looking at the actual empirical studies for astrology, for example. Now, let me say, you know, obviously with all the things that I've embraced, if astrology works, I'm going to be one of the first ones to champion it.
Are you going to tell us your sun sign, rising sign,
yes,
and moon?
Yes, Budweiser. I'm Aquarius. But I'm going to have it legally changed.
I don't think
I want to be
that,
in the age of Aquarius. I'm a cliche to be writing on this stuff in the age of Aquarius. So I think I should be, you know, anything, Leo, Sagittarius. I don't know where my moon is, but when I find it, I will tell you. it should report home. There have been over 300, at least 300, really good empirical tests of astrology done by astrologers with their cooperation. And these tests were ones that they were asked beforehand, before the test occurred, do you think this would be a fair test? And they only took the ones that they said, yes, this would be a fair test. And then they gave them the test, and before they scored it, they said, do you think you did well on this test? And they only took the ones where the astrologers said yes. And they came up with a 300, very carefully ones done. All 300 of them failed. Not a single success in all 300 of them. Now, at that point, you're allowed to ask some interesting questions.
Success in terms of what?
Oh, they would, for example, matching a profile to a person, an actual person, judging profiles, astrological readings, matching characteristics with particular individuals and so on. Whatever a general astrologer would tend to do when they're making pronouncements about people, situations, or future events. And again, these are only the tests designed with astrologers cooperating and saying, this is what I think would be fair test of what I think I'm doing. And all of those failed, literally, 300 out of 300. Now, at that point, you get to ask some interesting questions about it. Doesn't mean that astrology is therefore useless or valueless or it isn't doing something. Because again, I mean, everybody's right in some sense. There's a certain type of truth conveyed in virtually any belief structure that a person has. But if we're going to try to follow the rule that everybody's right, the only way to do that at some point is to realize that everybody can't be equally right. So in other words, there's such a thing as sort of being more inclusive, more right, more appropriate. It doesn't mean that other views are wrong. It means that at their own level, at their own dimension, they're giving an accurate enough view of how the world looks at that level, wave, stage, or whatnot. And most of the people that have looked at this, looked at the actual empirical evidence, looked at developmental scales as well, would say that astrology preeminently is a very sophisticated map of the mythic level of development. I mean, that's what the world looks like at that mythic stage of consciousness. So under those circumstances, it means that for that band in your own awareness, and these sort of seven bands of awareness we're talking about, that is a resonating value system for that particular wavelength in your own being. Now, it doesn't do everything it claims to do, at least according to these 300 tests that we were talking about, which is when it claims to be an empirical science, so to speak, to make actual predictions about what's happening or to give these actual characteristics that it claims to, it seems to fail on those counts. In other words, there's been no evidence that it does a scientific kind of thing in terms of predicting objective its and what they're going to do. So we can't say astrology, at least based on the evidence, we can't say astrology does that. But it does do other things in terms of I and we, in terms of the meaning structure at that stage or wave or band of consciousness, in terms of the value structure that it gives people, and in terms of the interpretive kind of overview that it gives people. If you are trying to believe in astrology as if it covers everything, then that's probably not right. That's where you have to sort of curb a belief system. It's when it pretends to cover all the bases but isn't really doing it in the way it claims to. So that's sort of a good news, bad news about astrology, but it doesn't just put it all in the realm of bunk, but it does say that it applies really to a very specific sort of band of development and not a band that's transrational for the most part, as far as we can tell.
What about the idea that by studying these symbols in astrology, or the symbols of the tarot, that opens the person to transrational insights?
Absolutely. And here's the difference, and this is where we have to be really careful. Joseph Campbell, probably the recent era's greatest mythologer and interpreter of mythology, and somebody I certainly cut my teeth on. I mean, I was a great admirer of his, and I thought he was really extraordinary work that he did. He used to very, very vehemently, actually, say that mythology, there's really sort of two types of mythology, or mythology forms two different functions. They're very similar to what we're talking about. He wouldn't use the terms pre-rational and transrational, but the way we're talking about them is the way he would talk about these two functions of mythology. And the first function is when mythology is taken to be concretely real. And that's Moses really did part the Red Sea, Christ really is born of a virgin, Lao Tzu really was 700 years old when he was born, and so on.
Lao Tzu wasn't 700?
No, he was 900 years old. Most myths, when they are originally embraced, created, and produced, are taken to be literally and concretely true. That if you actually look at whether it's a five-year-old or whether it's a fundamentalist religious believer, they don't take these things metaphorically. These are not symbols of some higher truth. These are the truth. Now, Moses really parted the Red Sea. This doesn't symbolize anything. There really was this guy called Moses, and he really did this thing. And he really had tablets, and he really did this, and he really did that. All of those would be what Campbell would call a concrete, literal belief in mythology. And he actually had some very harsh things to say about that. He said it's a perversion of myth, and so on and so on. Actually, I don't think so. About 95% of people that believe in myths believe them that way, certainly when they originally arise. But what some people do, particularly educated, intelligent people like us that are trying to get some meaning in our lives, we can tend to take myths as deeply symbolic of something else. In other words, it's something other than what the myth itself plainly says it's about. So when the myth says Moses parted the Red Sea, 95% of the people that believe that myth believe it concretely and literally. But people like us or like Joe Campbell might come in and say, oh, but it really represents this higher transpersonal thing. And then they tell you what they think it represents. But it doesn't represent that for most of the people that believe it. And for fundamentalist Christians or fundamentalist Jewish believers or fundamentalist Islamic believers or fundamentalist Hindu believers, these are concretely true. So that, to me, when that level three mythic conformist wave of development is also called concrete literal. It's concrete operational cognition. In James Fowler's Stages of Faith, it's a literal fundamentalist concrete belief that these myths are exactly what they say they are. They're not symbolic or metaphoric of anything. So we have to take that into account. I mean, we can't just sort of elevate every single mythic image we see to some sort of transrational, transpersonal glory. But some people take mythic images to be deeply symbolic of higher, even non-mental or trans-mental or trans-rational realities. It can represent a deeper self, a higher self. It can represent oneness with all of reality. Certain mythic images can be used to indicate divine lila, spontaneous manifestation. The Christ mythos itself is made to order for all sorts of interpretations. Now, for fundamentalist believers, Campbell's first type of mythology. There really was a person named Jesus of Nazareth. He really was crucified. He really did, 3 days later, rise and ascend bodily into this place called heaven, where he is sitting on the right hand of this guy named God the Father, and they are judging people left and right on Sundays. That's sort of what they do. That's all true. And when you die, you are going to join them if you've been good, and you're going to hell if you haven't. Now, I'm sort of caricaturing that. That's the fundamentalist belief of most of the people that hold that myth. It is, on the other hand, made to order for a transpersonal interpretation, which is that there are finite human beings, Jesus in this case, that if you die to your own separate self, if you die to your ego, you will find a oneness with the entire ground of being, God or Godhead. And therefore, you will resurrect a new destiny in your own life, which is the life of enlightened awareness, oneness with the world, atonement or at-one-ment, and all of Christ's life in that sense can be reread at that very, very high level of interpretation. I'm not against that. I'm just saying we also have to account for this other type of mythology of which really an enormous number of people believe, and it's not really transpersonal or transcendental in that sense. And Joe Campbell certainly agreed. So we have to keep that in mind. And the last thing is that Campbell was very, very clear. He said, the way you get to this higher mythology is you hold the mythic image in an as-if way. In other words, it's as if that were true. Now, and Campbell knew this, as if the capacity to form a cognition that says it's as if this is the case or would be, that is what we're calling a level 4 rational capacity. It doesn't come into existence until that level. That's why you can't hold an as-if view, a young child, until they're 10 or 11 years old. So any mythology, then therefore it's transrational. Obviously, if as-if comes into being with a rational level of development, then any as-if mythology has to be held by rationality or higher. So that's a very, very distinguishing way to tell the difference between pre-rational myths that are taken to be concretely, literally true, and transrational myths that may represent some very high transpersonal dimensions. So as long as we take both of those into account, then we have this sort of more integral overview. And the problem, again, with the pre-trans fallacy is that people like Freud take every transrational as-if higher mythology and reduce it to two-year-old infantile nonsense. And on the other hand, way too many people, including Jung on occasion, take a lot of the pre-rational stuff and elevate it to transrational glory it just doesn't have. And then things start to get very regressive and very kind of messy at that point.
This as-if phrase maybe is the clue then to answering this question that I'm still going to go back to. So we've got a diviner sitting in the corner throwing their I Ching coins or using the tarot. From the outside, how do you know if this person's operating at a pre-rational or trans-rational level? Would it be if they were able to say, I'm going to act as if?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you ask them exactly what is it that you're doing. And if they are basically saying, I am going to give you empirical evidence of what's going to happen tomorrow afternoon, then check it and find out. And that's a simple scientific test at that point. If they're making an empirical claim, check it empirically. And most of them, if you know, they are. They're somehow claiming that this ritual they're doing is going to have this kind of effect, and you can actually check it out. And if that's the case, check it out. On the other hand, if they frame what they're doing as I'm going to give you an interpretive reading about events that are important to you in your life right now, that's fine. That's a metaphoric orientation. And under those circumstances, you do a tarot reading based on your own sense. You're basically the person doing that kind of metaphoric tarot reading. Angiarian's probably the best in the world at doing that kind of tarot reading. The person will sit there and using a whole sort of intuitive awareness, their own development in various lines, cognitive development, intuitive development, emotional development, they're getting a read on this person. They're using the tarot cards to come up as a kind of Rorschach interpretive tool to help this person get in touch with some facets that they believe that this person might be out of touch with. Under those circumstances, it can be a very high kind of metaphoric event. Even if some of the original tarot cards were, in fact, a type of actual scientific divination, it was an attempt to tell what's going to happen next Thursday, or if it's going to rain or not, or if the Etruscans are going to attack this afternoon, and that kind of thing. On the other hand, people that play it as, I'm using this as a kind of secret science, it's going to tell you something about the real world that you don't know, that's very simple, you check it out. Many of those, unfortunately, are pre-rational and not trans-rational, or even rational for that matter. And the same goes for astrology. There are a lot of, let me hasten to add, there are a lot of I think they're really good people that use astrology. It's the same kind of thing. The original astrological system itself came from this level three mythic wave of awareness. But most astrologers today have access to a rational level or higher, and they use it in kind of the really good ones use it as an as-if interpretive tool or Rorschach blot to read something for people. To the extent they actually sort of dip back in and claim that this is a very predictive tool and this is definitely going to happen and don't go outside next Thursday, that's the predictions that have completely failed in every test that they've been given. And we just can't carry that part forward in terms of any sort of actual knowledge. It's just that the evidence doesn't support that. But really good astrologers can indeed do this sort of transrational as-if reading, and that's fine. It's absolutely fine.
Good.